It's Wednesday, January 24th, 2018, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as is every week, my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program today, we're going to talk a lot about the business of journalism, including Rupert Murdoch's suggestion that it's time for Facebook to pay news providers the same way that cable companies do. Huffington Post is abandoning its unpaid contributor platform, once the basis of its entire business model. We'll talk about why and what's going to replace it. And at a time when 54% of advertised journalism jobs are based in New York or the New York area, I want to ask Mike and Ernest about an idea being floated around that maybe it's time for our business to take a page out of Amazon's playbook. I'll explain more in a little bit. But first, let's talk about the shutdown of the federal government. Everyone went back to work with the start of business yesterday, but we could be back in the same spot 2 weeks from now. I want to start by asking each of you your thoughts on the coverage over the weekend.
Well, I mean, I thought the coverage was pretty much the same kind of coverage we've gotten in the other shutdowns and the other crises that we've been dealing with over the last year and a half. I think some of it was overblown. I think that a lot of it was more punditry than actual coverage. And we didn't get as much substance. But maybe that's because there really wasn't much substance there. We knew what the issues were. Yeah. We tried to cover the issues as best we could and then deal with the back and forth between.
I'll say, though, one of the things when you talk about substance that was missing that I actually found myself in my office Monday morning Googling, is there mail delivery today during the shutdown? Because I didn't, even sitting in front of the TV a good part of the weekend, I didn't know what services were available to me and what wasn't.
And that's a function of what Ernest was talking about. The coverage was overwhelmingly and predictably Washington-centric. To the extent that it even talked about who would be working, it was more about the federal employees in the D.C. area. There were a few exceptions. There were stories in the New York Times and elsewhere that talked a little bit about what services were going to be shut down and what ones weren't. But largely, it was about the conflict between the Republicans and the Democrats and Trump. And then nice little countdown clocks in the corner on cable TV.
Or count up clocks at that point.
But, you know, truthfully, there was one other part of it that I thought was weak.
Yeah.
And that was the coverage of anybody out there in the voting public who had an opinion contrary to what the media was saying about the Dreamers, like the relationship or the importance of the Dreamers versus immigration security or job security or whatever. It was pretty predictable coverage.
I mean, you know, a lot of the stories would start off, especially in terms of the Dreamers and DACA, that overwhelmingly, polls have shown that the public is supportive of this, and then they'd go right back to, but this is what is holding up the government from actually doing what it's supposed to do. This is what's holding up legislation in other areas in terms of defense, in terms of other immigration issues that we have to deal with, in terms of the economy. If we could just deal with these DACA people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I literally heard several people say, if we could just deal with these Dreamers. Mm-hmm. And That was the kind of rhetoric that you saw going into the 3 day shutdown, and here we are, 2 days, 3 days hence from the reopening of the government, and we're still using that same sort of language as if, you know, these people are not us.
And we're going to continue to hear it most likely for the next 15 days until we hit that next deadline.
No, and the political ramifications of this are real. I mean, not only in terms of the policy and not only in terms of Dreamers, but in terms of who controls Congress. Almost all the conversation so far has been about the Senate negotiations and whether Trump can be trusted or has a point of view or whatever. Mm-hmm. Not so much as being said about the House, because it looks like the Republicans are trying to keep it from getting to the House, because it might be one of those things that could be harmful as the Republicans are trying to hold on to control of the House. But still, even then, the coverage has been pretty predictable, I guess I would say.
One of the names we saw bandied around all weekend because she had a very large role both in, you know, votes Friday night and then trying to come up with the vote on continuing to pay the military, Claire McCaskill, making some decisions too that Do you see them helping her down the line here in the state? Is she's going up for re-election in November?
It's so hard to know from one week to the next what's going to stick with everything that's going on, mm-hmm. and with the way that we're covering this whole thing in the Trump era. But she is taking these votes, being very strategic. She and there were, what, four or five other Democrats who are in the states that Trump carried by 10, 15, 20% or more. She has to do it, even if we don't know what the ultimate impact is going to be.
And I think one of the things that you're going to see is that as we move into the election season, there are going to be politicians on both sides, especially those who are currently holding seats, who are going to have to make some pretty tough choices. And a lot of what they do is going to be dictated by what is the mood of the country and what's happening in the White House and what is the relationship between the president, the Congress, and the people.
Well, while we're talking about politics, we'd be remiss if we didn't follow up on a topic we'd mentioned a few weeks ago.
This is a Fox News alert. The Trump administration just announced the winners of the hotly anticipated fake news awards. Chief National Correspondent Ed Henry is at the White House with the results on the red carpet. Hey, Ed.
Okay, so we aren't going to stay with that. I'll just give you the spoiler alert right now. We here at Views of the News, we didn't get one. In fact, all 10 of them went to national news outlets, ABC's Brian Ross, CNN, The New York Times, Washington Post. And in just about every case, Trump and the Republican National Committee, the site where the awards were announced, kind of had a point. The reporting in those 10 stories, kind of sloppy, and in many cases did require publications to soften their original reporting or issue complete retractions. As much as I wanted to see this list be something where we could, you know, cast stones back at the administration and say, not fake news, they were reminders of some pretty strong errors in reporting and maybe trying to move too fast instead of waiting to slow down and be right.
Well, I mean, here again, the whole fake news thing.
Okay.
This wasn't fake news. These were errors made by news organizations that make errors all the time. Brian Ross has done this before. We talked about it on one of our shows. It's not like this hasn't happened before. CNN makes those kinds of mistakes all the time. So and their retractions and their clarifications. So it's when we get caught in this whole thing about, you know, calling it fake news, mm-hmm. that all of a sudden they were doing it on purpose. And that's not, none of these were purposely done. They were mistakes.
And as you said, they were, in most instances, the news organization put out a retraction or a clarification or whatever it might be, which is not something that the president does when he makes misstatements or an outright lies all the time. I thought it was funny, though, if our audience saw the video that you showed there with Tucker Carlson and the reporter Ed Henry from Fox News, they could barely contain.
Oh, yes.
You know,
it was the most breathless
laughter,
report you would ever.
Right?
Yeah.
And this was Fox News, which was the only news organization that took these awards seriously in the first place.
And didn't get one.
What I liked about it was the fact, Amy, that for once, I think most of the news organizations, even the ones who were the targets, didn't make a big self-righteous kind of, you know, breathless outrage report about it. They kind of let the late night comedians do that for them, and they just kind of let it roll on. And that's probably meaning that this story will not have the legs that it otherwise would have, because we're constantly referring back to ourselves.
Right.
Okay, well, as we're talking about that idea of fake news, we were talking a few weeks ago about an effort to make it illegal in Ireland. Well, it's actually already happened in Italy, and consumers there are being asked to notify authorities via a web portal of anything they encounter so that detectives can investigate the legitimacy of the published information. And I was reading about this and I was really curious. So I got in touch with a friend of mine who lives in Italy and asked him, did you know about this? And he said, I knew about it, but I wouldn't say a lot of people do, maybe about 20%. But he also said, until I shared the link with him, one of the links on our links blog, that he had no idea how to report fake news. So he thanked me for that. He's like, well, now I know. And I said, do you see people doing this? And he said, absolutely, because there is such a value put on avoiding misinformation and avoiding defamation of both individuals and businesses that it is very highly valued in that culture. So I said, okay, police investigating. Will people trust the police, trust the government in going ahead, investigating and setting the record straight? To which he said, yes, absolutely. There are people, though, who are worried that this is going to become an infringement on freedom of the press in that country and really have a chilling effect.
You know, there's so many angles to this. I mean, is it a problem? Yes. Is it a problem in Italy where they're having elections in, what is it, in March or May?
March, yeah.
Right? Yes. Are they trying to do something about it? Maybe more so than some other folks. But the whole thing of the government stepping in, the ruling party stepping in and saying, don't worry, we're going to police it and we're going to put out the correct information if you tell us something, some kind of fake news story, that just seems highly questionable to me.
Well, the thing that bothers me is that you have the ruling party doing this. What happens if the ruling party loses and another party comes in? You know, who's going to be in charge of this, you know, this force that is supposed to...
The devil you know is better than the devil you don't.
Exactly. And the other problem, when going back, if you read the stories on the Link blog, is that they aren't defining what is fake news.
Mm-hmm.
So if you turn someone in and you're claiming that it's fake news, what if it was just, you know, a misinterpretation of what happened, or it wasn't a fully vetted report? But there is some truth to it. I mean, it runs into so many problems when you go down that road.
And it says something about the bureaucratic and regulatory culture in Europe as well, to think that you could have an agency whose job is to do this all the time.
I mean, well, this is going to be just one of the responsibilities of this agency.
No, exactly. How is it possible that if people are actually turning in their concerns at a rate that would make any difference, that the police entity can actually carry out this job?
You know, but this goes to a deeper issue that's going on. I mean, we talked about our elections here in 2016. We talked about the Brexit vote and the impact and what was happening there. A lot of the fake news or the made up news, mm-hmm. was done by criminal organizations, or governmental organizations. I mean, that's what we have, the Russia probe going on here right now. You have a similar probe going on in London trying to determine about their elections there. To me, how do you police that? I don't know if you can police this. How can you police a state that uses this type of news or misinformation to help determine an outcome to their favor of an election?
I do think it was interesting, though, that the same folks who are pushing this call into the police, if you see fake news, are also pushing Facebook to get really serious about policing its own work. I mean, and the New York Times actually described Facebook as promising to dispatch a task force to Italy to tackle this. So maybe the threat of regulation is the only thing that gets these Goliaths
to
do something.
Nowhere in this conversation are we talking about, can we educate people on what is...
Thank you. So, right, this does come back to that idea of media literacy. And I wanted to drive it back a little bit to, like, we're seeing countries all across Europe trying to tackle misinformation in different ways. If it's the law that's being debated in Ireland, if it's this here in Italy, if it's the hate crime legislation and hate speech legislation in Germany. And I have to bring it back to the American audience a little bit and have to wonder, would I trust American news consumers with this type of a system? Read something that you believe to be fake news, something to be misinformation, go to another website and just plug in the information and report it.
Well, if your friend suggested, what, like 20% of folks were aware of this,
if I were to guess type of a number.
And maybe 20% of Americans who are really politically motivated would attend to this and might call in, or some fraction of them. So I don't think most of us would take advantage of the situation.
Okay, so while we have our focus on that side of the pond, I want to talk about, and Mike, you had brought up Facebook, I want to talk about Rupert Murdoch's statement to Mark Zuckerberg on Monday. We've been talking about the changes to the Facebook feed and the idea that personal connections and posts are going to be prioritized, with in turn the depression of posts from publishers. Well, Murdoch has an interesting response to that, and is suggesting that it's time that we, as publishers, stop giving our content to Facebook for free, that the social network should pay trusted news providers, like, say, Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, carriage fees, just like cable companies pay television networks. And maybe I'm a little bit naive, but I can think of maybe about a million different reasons that Zuckerberg is probably laughing at this notion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he is in the catbird seat right now. Unlike, say, you're talking about the restraint of trade that occurs when you have these television companies, and they're trying to get their carriage fees. Well, you know, you've got these lobbyists for local television stations and for the networks that are very powerful in this country, and so they can lobby to get these carriage fees. But who's lobbying to get Facebook to pay, you know, news providers? I don't think anybody's lobbying for that. Now we have Rupert Murdoch stepping up, and maybe this is the right time for him to be making this case. I just find it hard to believe it's going to go anywhere.
I'm not sure whether this is the right time. I think that the time to do it would have been way
years
well,
ago.
Yes, 15 well, years ago.
No, I was, thank you. I was about to say 15, 20 years
okay,
ago.
Maybe I'm thinking 8 you know, because I wasn't on Facebook till 10 or 11 years ago. I mean, and how long, when did we start using it for these purposes?
I remember back in the 90s when... Early 90s, when this was all forming, when the internet was pretty much forming, you had people in the industry who were saying, why are we giving this away for free? And the Wall Street Journal was one of those that didn't from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But now you have an environment where it is difficult to get people to pay for content. And now newspapers are starting to put up paywalls and these types of things. But you still have people with the ability to pull something off of one site, put it on their Facebook page and say, and tell their friends, hey, you know, take a look at this. And that's what Murdoch is talking about. He's saying, hey, our content is flowing out there because you have people who are sharing this information and we're not getting anything for it. Well, guess what? That's been happening for over a decade. And that's not going to stop, and you're not going to have, Mark Zuckerberg is not going to pay you for that.
Right, and the other part of it too, Mike, you were starting to bring up the idea, again, with the carriage fees here in the United States, the lobbying efforts that go into that, and consumers have been the ones who have really paid the price for it as cable bills right. have continued to rise. We've seen that on the local levels where, you know, the fighting matches that go on between local affiliates and DirecTV or MediaCom or whatever right. it might be to have that go on as they fight about the carriage fees. And what that's really led to has been more about consumer backlash and people cutting cords.
True, but I do think, and the reason that I said, Ernest, I thought this might be the right time for him to try it, mm-hmm. is because Facebook and Google are under such pressure now because of their role in fake news and in the changes that they've made to the algorithm and all of that. Maybe if you're going to push it, you push now. And he's not wrong, Murdoch.
Oh, no, I don't think he's
when
wrong
he says
at all.
There is value to this content that somebody should be paying for, but we in the news business have not found the way to get people to pay for it.
No.
It's not Facebook's problem.
Oh, no, I think he's absolutely right in terms of there's definitely value. I mean, right now for news organizations, the news and the news that they produce and that information, that is their main value. And what he's saying is that we're not getting a return on that because the current environment that we have allows people to get it without providing compensation back. And I think consumers will be hurt by this because these companies are going to shield themselves mm-hmm. from this, and they're going to pass it along to their consumers. That's the other problem here with what he's talking about is usually when those cable companies decide that they're going to raise their rates and you have these carrier battles going on, the consumers are the ones who lose out on it.
They are. And we talk about the timing being everything. This isn't the only Rupert Murdoch story, if you will. You know, there's the Facebook thing that comes up on Monday, and Tuesday we hear from British regulators that they are not likely to approve a merger between Murdoch's Fox and Sky News. That it again, bad for consumers there.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, they've been hinting that they weren't going to allow Rupert Murdoch to basically buy up Sky. And I think a lot of it goes to the fact that they just don't trust him. I mean, they don't want one person or one family to have total monopoly on what not just Britain, but also a huge swath of Europe sees on a major television operation. I mean, you're talking about next to the BBC, one of the largest network televisions in the world. So,
you know, you may be right about that, but I'll say this much from the stories that we've got on our Links blog. This isn't a done deal yet.
Oh, no,
this
it's
is
not done.
Some entity called the Competition and Markets Authority, which has said that it is tentatively or provisionally deciding that they shouldn't merge. There's still going to be some report coming out later in the spring. Theresa May's government doesn't necessarily have to go along with those recommendations. And there was even a piece on our blog from somebody, I think from Bloomberg, suggesting that, well, if you're going to say no, well, this was like the most delicate way to say no, because Murdoch, who's trying to sell his company to Disney, most of it, mm-hmm. let Disney come in and buy that. And his sons at least might still have a big role to play in this media empire.
I'm with you. I don't think it's done at all.
Okay, well, it's also been a busy week for staffers at the Los Angeles Times. There have been some pretty big changes there. Among those notable changes, the newsroom voted overwhelmingly to unionize. Its publisher was put on an indefinite leave for behaviors that it would be kind to call inappropriate. And yesterday, reports that its parent company, Tronc, is in negotiations with Axios to syndicate political coverage out of Washington, D.C. Now, the first two parts of this didn't surprise me all that much. The union organizers had a pretty good organization going. They had some strong leadership there, people in the newsroom who've been displeased with the management for a long time. That third one, though, that was the one that was the shock, because the first thought I had when I heard that, you know, Axios being that kind of Politico spinoff, that they were talking about perhaps syndicating that coverage was what happens to that long-storied Tribune Company Tronc Bureau that the LA Times is going to be losing its nuanced political coverage, the Chicago Tribune, the Orlando Sentinel, the political reporting that really pertains to each of those regions and is more focused.
Well, yeah, if this deal goes through, you're going to start to lose some of that.
Yeah.
This is not anything new. I mean, the Tribune Company, now Tronc, has been working for years to try to figure out how we can minimize our costs in our major bureaus, D.C. being one of them. And I think they have 16 reporters there now. They're talking about maybe if we move it to Axios, then Axios would take care of that, and then they would feed not only the LA Times, but Baltimore, Orlando, and other newspapers. And what happens to those 16? Do they become Axios employees, or are they going to stay with Tronc, or are they going to go out? More likely, they're going to lose their jobs, which is what usually happens when you have these cuts. This is all about trying to cut labor costs, which is the main cost of media organizations right now.
But it used to be, it was kind of a black and white argument. You've got your local journalists there covering the news from Washington from a local perspective, or you've got the wire services like the AP, which, you know, is kind of your Ford or Chevy of government coverage. Right. But now you've got this brand coming in there like Axios and Politico before them, the same people that started one, started the other. They have kind of a premium brand or a premium reputation for covering government. So if you structured this deal right, it might not be the best coverage that people
but
in those local markets
nothing,
can get,
yeah.
but pretty decent.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are some more editorial changes in play that we should be talking about as well. This time at the Huffington Post, referred to mainly as HuffPost, it's doing away with its unpaid contributor platform, once the backbone of the 13-year-old site. In that time, as many as 100,000 people have written everything from reported stories to personal essays. Some of them were aspiring journalists trying to work their way in the door. Some of them were celebrities straight from Arianna Huffington's Rolodex, but they gave Huffington Post its voice. This is probably the most sweeping change we've seen since Arianna Huffington stepped down and Lydia Polgreen took over there. What is the plan to replace that?
Well, Lydia Polgreen says that she's going to replace it by hiring more journalists from around the country, not just in New York, D.C., L.A., to cover stories. They're also putting together these two new offerings around opinion, and I forget what the second one was. So they're trying to
HuffPost personal.
Yeah, so they're restructuring it because they want to have more control. I mean, she was quoted in one piece as saying, when everyone has a megaphone, no one can be heard. And that's kind of the way that a lot of more traditional journalists have talked about user-generated content for a long time. I get why they're doing it, but I worry if the attitude is that the audience doesn't have anything to contribute to the news coverage that we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of wondering here if this is more about control than anything else. I mean, when you're bringing in that user-generated content, sometimes certain things will slip through the cracks, and then you get caught, and you're having to retrace that or having to pull that back in. By doing it this way, you have more control over your content, but I do think you lose out on certain things because, you know, that user-generated content seems to be closer to audiences than, say, something that's done by journalists who are stationed in a certain place and have to branch out all over the
place. I just think the more important part of that announcement was Polgreen promising that they're going to hire more established journalists to work, you know, in places other than on the coasts, but they haven't actually invested any money in that
yet. So let's talk about that. One of the stories on our links blog about The changes there is that they are going to be hiring people outside of New York and Washington. It's a fun fact to couple with another fascinating piece on our Lynx blog that challenges those in upper management to think more like Jeff Bezos and Amazon. It was pretty much impossible to miss the news the other day with the list of the 20 cities on the shortlist for the new Amazon HQ2, where we are in 2018. Why aren't there more media outlets considering doing the same? So let me lay out there for you what Joshua Benton's argument is. He's basically saying 54% of the jobs currently listed on the job site, journalismjobs.com, they're based in New York City. And his question is why. Rent there is super duper high. Cost of living is high, which means your cost of labor is even higher. Why aren't national news organizations considering that same HQ2 mentality and getting out to places like, I don't know, mid-Missouri?
Is it too cynical for me to say that elites love rubbing shoulders with elites? You know, it's a lot better to just parachute a journalist into the heartland and then bring me back to civilization after they've covered the story. That could even trump some business concerns sometimes.
No, I think Mike's absolutely right. I think the fact that you've always had these major media operations. I mean, you had New York, you've got DC, you got LA out on the West Coast. Chicago used to be that, and I think to a certain extent it still is, but not as big as it used to be in terms of media. This is where the people who want to do this want to live, and that we'll just parachute them in if we need to send them to, say, Nashville or Tuscaloosa or, you know,
okay,
you know,
but
Phoenix.
Let me ask you that, and maybe this is my Midwest sensibilities coming into play. The only two places I've ever lived have been the suburbs of Chicago and Columbia, Missouri. Mike, you're a Central Illinois guy,
right?
Columbia, Missouri, some time down in Texas. Ernest,
Texas.
Lots of time in Texas and here. Do journalists all want to live in New York, or isn't that kind of again, elites wanting to rub shoulders with elites? Isn't that a huge assumption, and isn't that how we got to where we are in 2018?
Well, I'll put it this way. The people who own the media want to live there. The higher-ups want to live there, and if you want to work for them, that's where you got to go.
And let's not take this Amazon, you know, initiative as being too close of a parallel either. Look what the 20 cities are. The vast majority of those are on the coast. The ones that are in flyover country are big urban cities, and only one of them, I think, you'd even call conservative. If you're trying to get a more cultural, different cultural point of view, that'd be Dallas. Every one of those is a more liberal city, probably.
I mean, and when you look at that as well, you got to think about where are we going to get where's our employment base going to come from? So if you're going to move that operation, you know, you want to make sure that you have people who can do the job who want to live there. And that's an issue, too, when you start talking about flyover country.
Okay. I would just say we have what I would consider a very strong journalism school here. We have competitors in this area, too. That music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our Lynx blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us some comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Austin Howard and John Saltzman have been our associate producers. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.